I'm Olga Koch. If you're listening to this, you're probably a forward thinker who works in financial services. If not, that's cool. I'm here for you being curious. Let me give you the gist of what this podcast is all about. Upfront is where you'll hear bold ideas and frank views about building a financial services business people truly love. Yep, I said love. In every episode, I'll be hitting up outspoken experts with a big question that tackles the industry's challenges head on. Like, how can we improve financial literacy? Why are some financial services experiences awesome and others not so awesome? I want to find out how financial services can go from being a turnoff for so many people to becoming a turn-on for everyone. Have you ever been turned on by a financial services experience? You need to email me at upfront@irez.com. If all of this is making you feel tingly, make sure you subscribe and follow Upfront on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. Today, we're talking about image. Take a quick trip around the online world of financial services, and you'll notice it's not always easy to differentiate one wealth manager or investment bank from the next. There's a lot of blue. Blue logos, blue websites, blue ties. Oh look, a man in a blue suit. It's all so predictable. What's up with the traditionally male corporate image? Is that doing anyone any favors when it comes to engaging with new, younger, and diverse audiences? Or even existing audiences for that matter? I've got two communications and branding experts here to give me their views on how financial services businesses are presenting themselves and what brands can do to stand out and stay memorable. Julia Streets, founder and CEO of Streets Consulting, a business development, marketing, and communications consultancy, and Michael Goff, founding strategy director of brand and design agency Sparks. So let's get into it. Michael, do financial services have to be so predictable?
No, is the quick answer. They don't. And there's massive opportunity for these businesses to think about their positioning, their relevancy, and the way that they engage the market.
My day job is I'm working with like small startups to some of the world's largest institutions. Okay, I think this might appeal to you. I'm a recovering stand-up comedian. So what's really interesting for me, so I rock up doing loads of events around the world. And sometimes they'll say to me, look, you know, we don't want you to dress the same brand as our competition. So when I turn up with a red jacket or a blue jacket, they're like, I don't think you can wear that, actually. And it's beginning to see various sort of pockets of colorways that some of the older financial institutions have been adopting. And I think part of that is because they're born for centuries and centuries and centuries of pedigree. So yeah. If you are hundreds of years old and you had a brand that you know, has evolved and probably been tweaked and adjusted slightly over time, you're going to naturally sort of fall within certain very corporate colorways. What's wonderful to see, of course, these fintechs that are coming through, the early stage entrepreneurial companies. There's quite a lot of vibrant green coming through, which suggests that we're a massive great nod to sustainability and climate change. But there is a bit of a trend, I think, of people adopting different colours. The key thing, ultimately, is trust. So if you trust that a blue or a red or a black brand are going to be very, very trustworthy, you might naturally fall towards those. But if you go for something that's more of a vibrant orange or a lime green, you're going to have a very, very different emotional reaction. And when you're talking about people's money, particularly in a highly regulated market, that is all shifting, which is really fun to watch, actually. It's fun to see.
Do you feel like there's only so much they can do? Because otherwise they'll just appear not trustworthy for consumers or other businesses.
Trust is really important, but it's also about recall and memorability. Working in brand and brand strategy, the first thing at our job is, can we make sure that we're remembered? On one level, I think Julie's right. You can go as far as you like to create that memorability, but obviously there is a balance between making sure that there is a sense of trust there as well, that these guys are, you know, that we're dependable, we're reliable, we're a safe pair of hands. The industry has relied too much on that. The point is, you know, am I going to be remembered? Is my business going to be remembered by the target audience at the point when they're going to instruct someone?
We all remember the first time we went on a date with someone with a bright orange Monzo card. I know I do.
Yes, absolutely. And everyone talked about it, didn't they? Pulled it out of their wallets and everyone got really excited about the fluoro orange.
So Julie, you touched upon greenwashing. How do both of you feel about greenwashing in the industry and how much of it is lip service and how much of it is actually action?
There is a lot of appetite from investors to understand that their money, particularly in the world of investments, is going into funds that are ethical that are green, that are sustainable, and that are ultimately well-governed, ESG, environmental social governance. However, the ability to measure that is quite random at the moment. There are certain sort of governance structures being put in place and certain data that is coming through that provides a transparency around that. But then at the other end, the more cynical end of the point of view is people go, well, you know, if you stick a little bit of green stuff on your brochures and your prospectuses, then people will believe that they are suitably environmentally conscious.
The idea of brand purpose and business purpose is kind of really current at the moment. But a lot of people are thinking about what's the difference that they're making in the world? And is that difference positive? My frustration is it always becomes a dichotomy that you either have to choose purpose or you have to choose profit. That somehow there is this kind of dichotomy that exists between the two. And somehow that just seems quite naive that you can only have one or the other. And I think there needs to be much more nuance on the topic to think about, you know, how can these two central planks of impact work together rather than compete together?
And, you know, I'm quite optimistic, actually, in the middle of that, because I'm hearing more and more people talk. There's digital ethical changes afoot as well. So when you think about how business models and how data is being constructed in a way that not only supports the transparency point, but also the digital ethical structures and creation of product, which means that people can say, well, actually, we can have purpose. And we can have profits because actually the way that we're constructing all our technology in the heart of what we do recognizes that there has to be a synergy between the two. The reason why I pick up those two particularly is because it comes to an undeniable truth. No shareholder is ever going to go, well, I think investing in technology is a very bad idea. And no customer is ever going to go, no, I'd rather have mine delivered by paper. That does align the profit and the purpose conversation quite neatly.
Is purpose something that companies have been made to think about only recently? It does feel like quite a recent trend. And Michael, you even touched upon the idea of like that brand development being a recent thing, given the fact that it was just companies talking to other companies.
I think there's a growing awareness that brand does more than just, it's more than the logo or the color palette. The best definition of brand that I heard is often associated with Jeff Bezos. He describes brand as being what people say about you when you're not in the room. Thinking particularly about financial services, I think there's a massive opportunity for financial services to think about the reality of financial illiteracy that exists in the UK, which is pretty significant and pretty high, and has only been exacerbated by everything that we've endured over the last kind of 24 months or so. And there's a real need to actually help people see the value of financial services beyond the features of what it offers into actually the difference it's going to make by engaging with these services. And that's all about purpose.
Well, when you talk about sort of social inclusion, financial inclusion, and extending the distribution of financial products and services to people around the country for whom, you know, their relationship with banking and financial services was probably so remote, if not non-existent. That is a huge opportunity. And forgive me for being very capitalist on this, but I don't think the purpose of profit should be remote. You know, it's about creating wealth for all,
yeah.
Economic impact for all. It's about helping entrepreneurs get their businesses started in order to grow them, to employ people, to pay taxes, and also to invest elsewhere. And it's also about reaching out to people in society who can get themselves on their feet, who can get into the workforce, who can start earning and providing and saving and having better financial pathways of personal empowerment all the way through their life journeys. And imagine then how you can inspire a future generation. Imagine how then you can be bringing communities together collectively to really make an impact as well. So we tend to look at this sort of quite sort of siloed through a corporate point of view, direct customer, customer direct. But exactly as Michael was saying, is you can extend its potential so, so much wider. And that can only be good for everybody.
And it's quite a brave move as well, I think, because it requires long-term thinking and long-term planning.
And we have to start now, by the way. You know, the risk with these kind of conversations, people go, okay, yeah, no, I'll worry about that perhaps, you know, kind of 2023, 24, 25. We'll put it into our next five-year plan. The reason why we have to do it now is because, A, we're coming out of a pandemic. Here in the UK, we're going through Brexit, right? We're going through the economic implications of some geopolitical decisions that have been made by the nation. Let's not get into that. We have to, as brands, position ourselves as organisations where people want to work. And I think this is one of the biggest challenges facing the financial services industry right now is, do our brands stand for organisations where rising talent is coming in and going, yeah, okay, that looks like the kind of place I'd want to work. And by the way, that's the kind of place where I'd want to stay. And that I think they will empower my journey. And in that, of course, is the really important conversation about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And if we want to be out empowering communities to engage with financial services, we have to bring in talent that understands what those communities need. So think about social inclusion and social ascension, but also thinking about into LGBT communities, ethnic minority communities, disability communities. That is why we have to have that talent within our organizations, as well as trying to serve it outside as well.
Yeah, and which is where purpose is so important to help us shape the narrative to attract the right talent.
Changing the perception from purpose being an afterthought after profit and more profit being the result of purpose.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so purpose is the driver and the consequence is profit.
So let's look at the digital transformation that's happened throughout the pandemic. Think about the world of payments. How we now interact and integrate our personal finances and our savings and our investments, which hopefully everybody has got a pension, but we're doing that all digitally now. That's all completely online. How these organizations are having to transform in terms of the future of work and the world of work. You know, here we are, we're all sitting remotely, might be in an office, you might not be, hybrid, different days. We're all having to work very differently and we're having to attract talent very differently and we're trying to extend our reach as organizations. And that's why you have to think about this stuff right now. And exactly, to echo Michael's remarks, purpose has to be at the core of everything you're thinking about, not an afterthought.
I also can't stop thinking about the Jeff Bezos quote. I think it's really poignant. I'm assuming he invented the Alexa to hear what people are saying when he leaves the room.
I'd imagine so.
We talked a lot about purpose and the idea of like sort of thinking of all the communities who are potentially not financially literate or represented in financial services. And I think, as with greenwashing, there is a lot of danger of sort of outwardly presenting that way, but not really doing the work for it. So recently, I believe you were sent a link to an ad. We don't want to be too specific with what the company was, but I think it was quite a macho angle on financial services with a lot of football and just white men in shot. And yet, if you go on their website, the company is sort of signaling and saying that diversity and inclusion are at the core of who they are and what they do. How does this sort of behavior make you feel?
So I host a podcast all about diversity and inclusion in financial services. And forgive the plug, but it's called Diversity Podcast. And we've got listeners in 55 plus countries. And the number of people who I get pitches from going, I want to come in and talk about how D&I is in our DNA. You check out their website, and this is exactly the kind of marketing that you will see. It's just one step removed when you start creating campaigns that are clearly biased in their production. Now, we have to be really mindful of biases, conscious bias and unconscious bias. And I could have a whole nother debate about whether, you know, how you tackle conscious and unconscious bias within organizations. But you need to be holding also your suppliers to higher account. Also, to be holding yourself to a higher account with your agency to go, is this good enough? Actually, and does it align with our values? And exactly as we were saying before, our purpose as well.
And what prompted you to start the podcast and how did you start it?
Every good story should start like this. I was so angry. I was standing at the House of Commons. I was at a reception, and a diversity and inclusion reception. The House of Commons, watching all of these corporates, these big financial institutions and some small ones, bleat on about their commitment to diversity and inclusion. And I'm thinking, well, why? When I've met so many amazing people who are doing great things and trying to bring more talent into the industry. And yet we have these banks and financial institutions who are claiming that D&I is in their DNA and look at our brochureware. Why is it taking so long to change? And I just had too many questions. And so I started 5 years ago and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of guests from the bank, governor of the Bank of England to the FCA, but also right into smaller community groups, groups like Sikhs in the city. And groups thinking about young female Muslim employees in the city and really trying to uncover, you know, the voices from within and thinking about the talent. And that's kind of why some of my remarks have revealed themselves as they have done. Because actually, we've got to get to the heart of why things aren't changing fast enough, because that's what ultimately was going to drive the next generation and also the innovation that's happening in the industry.
Are there common threads in what the sort of preconceived notions about financial services are within marginalized communities?
Well, I think people just don't have a relationship with them. Is that people are going, well, why would I care about the city? Why would I care about financial services? I mean, what does that mean to me? It probably doesn't mean a great deal at all. I don't want to work with a bank that's hundreds of years old, that presents itself in a, coming back to the original question, a red or blue logo, when actually I could be working with a Monzo. I could be working with a Challenger Bank. And you know, there are many examples of that. It's about how do you connect? And I think many younger generations are coming through and marginalized communities are coming through just going, it's an alien world to me.
Yeah, it's about relevancy, isn't it? It's being able to articulate the relevancy of the service to the target audience. And the vast majority of the UK population just don't see the relevance of financial services. They don't understand the difference it can make to have a financial planner working alongside you to help you understand, you know, how to plan for your future. The fantastic thing about financial services is there's a great opportunity to create freedom, isn't there, and liberty in order to free people up to do the things they want to do because they're no longer necessarily beholden to their finances. And so making people literate in finance gives them a kind of mobility that allows them to kind of think beyond the kind of here and now to a bigger opportunity. Again, it's coming back to that relevancy question, being able to demonstrate the relevancy of this service. You know, the benefit of what I'm going to help you do means that you can retire early or you can go and do X, Y, Z, A, B, C, that kind of life plan you have. It creates liberty. And so you demonstrate the value at that point.
Thank you very much for that. Just piggybacking on this, on your answer, and just throwing a question to both of you. Are there examples of specific campaigns or specific actions that financial services companies have taken that you feel are authentically inclusive and actually putting their money where their mouth is when it comes to purpose?
The businesses are too quick to assume their relevance rather than to actually work out what is it that they're doing that actually does connect to their audience. There just isn't enough time given by companies to actually work out where they fit in the market. What is it that they're bringing to the market that is distinct from others? And that sort of diagnosis just needs thinking about much harder, much more rigorously, you know. And once you get a line in the sand, to be able to then test that, to go out and test your assumptions about that relevancy, to see, does that actually key with the target audience that we're trying to engage with?
I completely feel that because there's so many assumptions about just people... Oh, God. Okay, sorry. There's a love interruption. That's the sound of love. So we're going to go with that feeling. I want you both to take a deep breath.
I'm just going to do a late night radio show. I love it.
I want you both to take a deep breath, listen to the music, and feel all the feels. We've been getting into the issues and the stuff that ticks us off about financial services. But how about what you love about financial services? Is there something you love about financial services?
I think it's potential. It's unrealized potential to help people see the opportunity that they have to create personal freedom and liberty from financial constraints with good advice. The difference between telling a 20-year-old to think about their pension and a 50-year-old about their pension is enormous. And so there's real potential here and real opportunity to help people develop financial freedom, but it's just unrealized.
And for me, there are five generations working in financial services. We've never had five generations ever working in the industry before. And if you start to think about what that means, again, to agree, the potential is phenomenal, particularly in the world of fintech, where we've got young entrepreneurs coming through that don't necessarily have the business experience. So therefore, the older generations and their ability to mentor and to coach and support is incredible. Then you've got older generations who are thinking about what their legacy going to be as they leave organizations and really kind of bringing younger talent and bringing enlightened leaders through in their stead. Now, those who get that will leave an incredible legacy of just going, actually, I hired and I trained and developed leaders who did not lead like me because I was trained at a different time. And particularly right now, when you think how the world has shifted, those enlightened leaders who get the joke will fly. They will do incredibly well in this industry.
I've never thought of it that way. That's the feeling that you get when you see your parents on Facebook and then you realize there's five generations working in the same industry. As this segment is meant to be sort of like a relationship podcast vibe, I'm going to ask a second question. Hopefully there'll be very sexy royalty-free Barry White music underneath. We all have some kind of relationship with financial services, regardless of whether we work in them or don't. So I want to get into your relationship with it. What's the one thing you want financial services to break up with for good? What needs to get dumped?
I think it's obsession with features and talk about benefits. Stop talking about how important your client servicing is. Of course it's important. You wouldn't be in business if it wasn't important. We had a number of clients a while ago that would come to us and they would say, look, we've already worked out what makes us distinctive. We know that we're friendly, we know we're approachable, and then we know that we're professional. That's why we exist, that's what makes us significant as a business. And then you hold the mirror up and say, well, hang on a minute, would the opposite ever be true? Would anyone in the market say they were unfriendly, unapproachable, and unprofessional? I mean, it's a given. And this industry is rife with this. A really simple exercise that listeners can do if they're wanting to work out how distinctive they are. Grab your About Us statement from your website, anonymize it, take out any reference to the company. Go and find 9 other competitors in the same space, whether that's by geography or location or what Google says compares to you. Get their About Us statements, stick them all in a file, take away any typography, make them all the same size. Take out any reference to the company, forget about it for a few days, come back to it and reread those statements. I guarantee they will all say the same thing. They will all talk about exactly the same things about customer service, about their expertise, about being a leading light in some form. And as a result, there's just no choice in the market. The consumer doesn't know who to choose because everyone is just generic, bland and vanilla. There's no kind of point of distinction.
I love that. There's so much kind of leading provider of next generation paradigm shifting technology solutions. What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Julia, do you have a specific thing that you would like the financial services industry to dump?
Yeah, the assumptions. They're just incredible assumptions that are made daily about what consumers need, what investors need, what organizations, if you're investing in the kind of small to medium-sized enterprises, what the growth companies need, what your employees need. There are so, so many ingrained assumptions. I mean, you can't rip up the rule book because it's a regulated industry. I would just like to make that crystal clear. I am not saying...
This podcast is not advising for you to break the law.
Exactly. Teach the rule. No, I'm not saying that for sure. But actually, the assumptions...
That concludes that segment, and I think those are very, very excellent answers for that. Does the industry have the imagination to take creative strides and keep the regulators comfortable at the same time?
I mean, it depends on risk, though, doesn't it? I mean, you hear a lot about risk profiles in financial services. It's going to take some business owners to take some risks to actually try and do this in a way that's sincere and authentic. And moves away from the kind of bland and the predictable. And that's going to require some strength of character to do that.
And there are loads of them out there. The wonderful thing about fintech innovators is they don't tend to be the young PhD graduates. They tend to be people who have worked in the industry for many years, seen some of the kind of the entrenched incumbent behaviors and gone, technology is a great way to do something differently. So therefore, they tend to be even at a life stage that they're prepared to take risk. In order to do that, but also understand risk, which is regulatory risk, operating risk, systemic risk, and then also customer risk as well. So they are very minded to the best way in which to innovate and take the regulators with you on that journey as well.
Michael, you specialize in working with brands with rich histories to express why they matter now. Could you talk us through a case study that might inspire our listeners?
Yeah, so we did some work with a fiduciary service that used to be part of Rothschild, and they were sold off and they needed to change their name and work out their own identity. And we helped them think about, you know, how do you make sure that you carry the heritage with you, that you don't just kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater and just come across as this kind of new kid on the block. It's really important in that kind of fiduciary work that you really are seen as a kind of discreet, safe pair of hands when you're talking with ultra high net worth individuals. And so we spent a lot of time with the senior leaders, understanding the nuance, understanding the journey they've been on for the last kind of 25, 30 years of the business. And now it was in this transition into new ownership and helping them kind of crystallize what is it that makes them different and where we settled after lots of iterations. And you know, we see this as very much as a kind of collaboration. It's never us as an agency coming in and imposing what we think. It's actually that kind of coaching thing of drawing out what's already there and kind of crystallizing it for them. So there is always something there in the origin story, in the founder story. If you give enough time to that review stage where you're kind of spending time looking at the existing material to work out what is still relevant, what is still cogent for the target audience as you kind of evolve and develop.
I think it's really interesting that both of your answers had to do with like balancing two opposing forces, and with Julia saying the force of regulation and innovation. And for Michael, it's being like old school and new school. And that's clearly just a tug of war across the board within the industry. But I think the core question remains, what color do you choose on the Pantone color chart?
And that reflects the pedigree that goes before. And I think that's the interesting thing, which is why I don't think we're seeing any, my feeling is particularly when it comes to corporate infrastructure players who are spinning out businesses, they tend to rely on a cog shift away from what's gone before. Whereas if you are a complete setup from nothing, it tends to be, we're going to throw out a bright pink because we can. You know, it's really fascinating watching that kind of, as you say, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's think about how do we capture the pedigree in how we offer it as well. And that's really important, actually.
Yeah.
Now that we've talked about all of the issues, let's get to the solution. How can financial services stop being so predictable? And what advice does the industry need to hear?
Well, I think it always starts with audience. Be really clear who you're going after. Who is your target audience? Get in as much granular detail as you can. We often write kind of audience personas. It's not a kind of, there's no unique methodology here, but it's kind of, you know, sitting in the shoes of your target audience and really working out what is it that's going on in their lives and where is the point of connection and point of relevance for your service. And remember that you as a business are tiny in terms of your influence in their world. You're one of 1,000, 10,000 things that they're worried about that day. And so what you've got to do to cut through is be really distinctive. Be clear, concise, and compelling. Those are the kind of three words, nice bit of alliteration there for businesses. You know, in what way are you kind of speaking to their needs in a way that's clear, concise, and compelling? And that would go a long way to help you connect to your audience.
Michael makes a really good point about, you know, you're only a small part in people's financial services and what they need, but also you're only a small part in the ability to create and distribute. So I think one of the things that the industry really needs to think about, which is about collaboration. Which is, you know, you could be really, really good at something, but it's so important to align and collaborate with others in order to extend your services. We are at the most incredible, almost kind of inflection point of where financial services can really embed into people's lives. So when we think about how we use our phones, how we use our devices, and how we spend our lives at work, at home, and at play. The more financial services and the world of payments, the world of investments, the world of cash, digitally enabled transfer of funds, let's call it, the way that all works is now being empowered by the user, not by the institution. So by collaborating with all sorts of different providers, you can now align, and it's the whole concept of open banking, where you can now align using application programmable interfaces, which is APIs, basically where your data can come together. So that the user, the consumer, the investor, or the organization can look at it in one view and take a holistic view of everything that's going on in their financial life. Whether that's treasury, which is the management of corporate cash, to me individually going, how much money do I have left this month and what am I spending it on? So the only way to do that is by collaborating. And there are now open architecture models where organizations can come together and integrate very easily. And there's also a lot of policy and regulation that's going around enabling that so that investors, consumers, corporates of whatever size are always protected. But also then new entrants can come into the market who can do their one piece of the jigsaw puzzle. They can do that in a smarter way than anybody else can, but they are also able to play and able to provide their services. And historically, financial services has always taken the view of going, it's our institution, it's our products and services. We will never integrate with anyone else. Now that has all been thrown on its head. And it's about going, how do we, as an institution that may be hundreds of years old, how do we integrate with a fintech that's very good and probably a matter of months old? How do we all get to work together? Because actually it's the consumer, the corporate, or the investor who wants better products and services delivered to them the way that they want to consume them.
I want to thank Julia Streets and Michael Goff for keeping it real with us on the podcast today. And I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen. If you want to know more about our guests or get some advice on building a stronger, more memorable financial brand, then head to our podcast notes for a link to the Upfront blog. Maybe something someone said stirred something inside of you and you feel an urge to share it with me? Send me a voice note or drop me a line at upfront@irs.com. If you thought, damn, Olga Koch really knows how to make financial services surprisingly sexy, you need to subscribe and follow Upfront wherever you listen to your podcast so you don't miss the next episode. Next time, I talk bullshit. And while you shouldn't need a PhD to understand your finances, you don't want to miss that.